Well, welcome everybody to this special extra Leslie Riddick podcast. And I'm very, very chuffed that my pal of many decades, actually, known more to you as the veteran land campaigner, former MSP and Green Andy Whiteman, has joined us in Woods in Lochaber. Pat's here as well, but Andy, hello.
Hello. Good morning to you both. Nice to see you.
You'll hear that the line is a bit shonky because actually this is Andy's life now from having been sort of sitting in the Parliament with as good a broadband as you get in a building in Edinburgh. He's now using his phone to tether to be able to sort of communicate from the world from the middle of the woods. So we're hoping this is going to hold up. You might hear a wee gap after I ask or Pat asks a question. That's not because Andy, as you know, is in the least slow, but just because it seems to settle the line a bit in his responses. So that's how we're approaching this. Andy, probably the first thing everybody really wants to know is, how are you?
I'm grand. It's good in a sense to be living a more normal life. Life as an MSP is hectic and very busy and fairly exhausting if you're doing the job properly. And much of the time, to be perfectly frank, is not that stimulating because you're doing very, very important, worthy stuff. But it may not be the most gripping to you personally. And it's also good to be, as you say, living in the woods, getting back to nature. Just enjoying the rhythms of the natural world.
Yeah, the natural world, which hasn't rained enough lately, eh?
It's been a very strange winter, and it's been very dry over the last week. We get our water from the roof, and we then filter it. But the water butts are dry, so we're having to go down to the river to get our water. So I would like some rain.
Right. So when it happens, everyone, it's Andy Whiteman's fault.
Aye.
Andy, just though going back to what happened when you moved from Edinburgh and stood on the Highland list as an independent. I think a lot of us were so hopeful that you would get in. Why do you think you didn't?
Well, you'd have to go and ask all the voters of the Highlands and Islands. I mean, it wasn't for want of trying. I raised a decent campaign fund of about £15,000, which, £9,000 gets you a leaflet printed and then you get the free distribution by the Royal Mail. And the other £6,000 was spent on posters and various other expenses. So I was running a professional campaign, as it were. And it is, in theory, easier to stand as an independent with modern digital communications, with social media, etc., easier to get to people. But that's a double-edged sword because you can also be get a bit complacent because social media is actually a bubble. And you've got to get to the plumber in Dingwall and the shopkeeper in Broadford, and they're busy people, and they're not on the internet or on social media looking out for my chat. So I traveled 2,000 miles, met a lot of people, but at the end of the day, I think I was kind of hoping that partly the prospect of an independent would be attractive to a region of Scotland which has returned independence at local councils and continues to return independence, and because I think the Parliament would benefit from one or two or three independents. But at the end of the day, day in, day out, the radio and the television were broadcasting Willie Rennie and Anna Sarwar and the First Minister. It's very difficult to cut through in the mainstream media, by which I mean the print media, but principally radio and television. So the big challenge is to let people know you're standing and then give them enough information to make them wonder whether you're worth voting for. And I think just the combination of all that was a bit too much of an ask. And plus, we're still living in a politics which is highly conditioned by your views on the constitution, and people are still seeing elections, indeed even to local councils in the next few weeks, and Holyrood as almost a referendum and where you stand in the constitution, rather than you're electing seven MSPs, what kind of people do you want to represent you? And I was playing much to the latter, but I think it was eclipsed by the former.
Yes, I must say, knowing a lot of folk in the Highlands, I spoke to people who just, even if you explained all the logistics of the way the voting worked, were just too scared to not give the SNP both their votes or the SNP Greens, simply to keep the independence vote high. But then the other thing that other people might have wondered is why you left Edinburgh, actually, to move to the Highlands, because I think people feel you would have got elected in the Edinburgh List constituency.
Well, of course, I left the Scottish Greens in December 2020. And so had I stayed in Lothian, I would have been standing as an independent. I don't think I would have got in Lothian either. I mean, I might have got some more votes. I might have got to 8,000-9,000, but not the sort of 12,000-14,000, which is the threshold for getting a place on the list. So I actually didn't think I would stand at any better a chance in Lothian than Highlands. I mean, a move to Lochaber had been in the cards for some time. There's family reasons here, to do with parents, and my mum lives on Skye, and there'd been various developments and not developments over the years. So this has been on the cards for a while, and it just kind of all came together a year ago. So, yeah, I mean, it wasn't driven by any electoral calculation, put it that way. I mean, I didn't think that I had any better or worse chance in the Highlands than the Lothians.
And just on that, when you were talking before about essentially, you know, that an independent easily gets squeezed. And that is so true, because we were both involved, but me more so in a wee party that stood in the very first Scottish Parliament elections in the Highlands area, the Highlands and Islands Alliance. And it was standing part-time candidates, you know, and there's loads of part-timers in the Highlands. There was all sorts of aspects of it that should have fitted the Highland mindset, if you like. And we got nowhere. I mean, I wasn't a candidate because I was working for the Beeb at the time, but it really forced it on me as to how totally invisible you become once the big grinding machines are working.
That's right, yes. And perhaps it was always thus. I mean, if you look back at the Scottish Parliament elections, the only independents to have been elected, they fall into two categories. I mean, one is I think there was a hospital campaigner, Bears Den, Jean, somebody. Apologies, don't forget her name. But that resolved around a big local issue, which people felt very, very strongly about, strongly enough that they voted for a candidate standing purely on that ticket. And I think the Older People's Party, I can't remember how they got in, but again, you know, they had very particular campaign and constituency. And then the other class of people are the Margaret MacDonalds and the Dennis Canavans, who'd already had a life in politics, who were very, very well known, who'd been elected as party members in their areas, but hadn't been selected for their parties subsequently and decided to give it a shot on their own. So they had sufficient name recognition and hinterland to be able to make a success of that. But otherwise I think it is very difficult, yes.
Pat, on you come.
Andy, I was just actually thinking about it. I mean, what's the experience been like of moving from activist to elected party politician and then subsequently back again? Because you did stand for the as an independent. So you obviously think there is some purpose at being in Parliament. So what's it been like?
Well, I mean, I mainly stood because I wanted to, you know, give it a go. And also I wanted people to have the choice. So it's fairly basic democratic instinct. I'm not what some people call a career politician. You know, I have no interest, I've never had any interest in getting into elected politics and staying there for as long as you can, bending whatever rules you need to along the way to keep your place in Parliament, etc. You know, it was a great opportunity and a massive learning experience to be there for 5 years. But I've always been clear that politics is about what you do in your everyday life. We're all political. We're making political decisions when we decide what to eat. We're making decisions politically within our families and communities about various decisions that have to be taken. So, I mean, politics is about the arbitration of power. It's about how you negotiate power. So we're doing it all the time. So elected politics is just one part of that, albeit a very, very important part. And I often felt when I was in Parliament that on any particular issue, that in many cases, I would be more effective outside than inside. Because when you're inside, as I said earlier, you're a bit of a prisoner. You've got to do a lot of very important, worthy stuff that nevertheless doesn't really get you up in the morning and potentially takes a lot of time. And then the things that you're more interested in, and of course everything's on a spectrum, you generally speaking don't have the time to devote to as much as you would like. So I often felt that being outside, where I could devote more time to the things I felt I could make a difference on, would actually be more effective. So I'm not, I'm in no way unhappy about not being there. I mean, I think this Parliament is going to be quite difficult, you know, coming out of, we're still dealing with the aftermath of Brexit. We're still dealing with, we just started to deal with the aftermath of COVID. You've got constitutional politics dominating. You've got a fairly bad-tempered political discourse. Now you've got kind of war in Ukraine and global tensions. It's not, and I listen and observe parliamentary proceedings, and it's still not the kind of place and the kind of atmosphere that I anticipated the Scottish Parliament would be. Still a lot of bad temperedness, still a lot of divisiveness, still a lot of partisanship, and none of that appeals to me, frankly.
Well, you say you were, in a sense, you know, an MSP is a prisoner of the many things that it's your duty to do as part of the job. But you were also essentially a prisoner, essentially, of the party, of the Green Party in the end. Has that been a difficult thing to put behind you?
It has at times, yes. And I mean, you know, a lot of people say that, you know, we split over the trans issue. That's not why I left. I mean, I left because I couldn't work in an environment where if you had a different point of view, you'd be threatened with expulsion or discipline. I mean, regardless of what the issue might have been. And, you know, I wrote a blog latterly explaining it all. And yeah, I don't like working in that atmosphere. Other people do. That's fine. You know, I don't. So, and yes, it has been, I suppose, a bit difficult, because when you get involved in a political party, it is like another family, you know. Mm-hmm. These relationships can be very intense and profound, and to sort of break them all and to experience some of the kind of bitterness and backlash that comes in the wake of leaving can be a bit difficult. But, you know, broadly speaking, no, I've moved on from that.
Yeah. And just to complete all of the things that are sitting probably in people's minds, you mentioned also the constitutional politics and, you know, that being one of the things that sits in the on the agenda. Do you think there will be an independence referendum next year?
No. In fact, cool. My view is that there shouldn't be one. And I going into the 2021 election, I didn't think it was appropriate to have one. I mean, I say that not because I don't want an independence referendum. I mean, I think it is right that the people should have their say again. I say that more because it's a question of When we, I mean, I was quite involved, as I think you were in the 90s in the lead up to the devolution referendum and the establishment of the Scottish Parliament. And by, you know, the beginning of the 90s, there was what I think Donald Tuir called the settled consensus in Scotland that we needed a parliament. And from that moment on, it was a question of just resolving some of the more detailed, some of the fairly big questions, actually, about what that parliament should look like. And I've always felt as a matter of democratic politics that the idea that we would go into an election where people are still basically 50-50, and, you know, you could vote for independence on 50% plus one, doesn't, I'm not comfortable with that. I'd far, far rather go into a referendum when it was fairly clear that, if not the settled will of the people, it was certainly the settled will of a majority, you know, of the people on a consistent basis. So, there will not be a referendum next year. I mean, the UK government is not going to give consent to it. And if the Scottish Parliament votes through legislation to have one, it'll be challenged in the courts, in the Supreme Court. And maybe we'll find that it is within the legislative competence of the Scottish Parliament to have a binding independence referendum. Maybe we will. But the kind of the balance of opinion legally is that the Supreme Court would find against any such legislation.
But I wonder, would you not think that the kind of the deadlock that you describe and some of the rattiness and the endless posturing and people having to be against things because they're on the other side of the constitutional divide, and the kind of weariness everybody feels. I mean, even conservative commentators like Andy McKeever want another referendum to simply clear up or clear down what the immediate future looks like.
Yes, no, that is an argument. That is an argument, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I wouldn't... I've got no power, but I wouldn't stand in the way of having one next year if it was going to happen. You know, it's just my personal preference about the circumstances in which it should take place is not that. But no, I mean, that's a good argument. That's a good argument. But of course, the risk there, if you support an independent Scotland, the risk there is you might lose because everyone, you know, I mean, you know, Ukraine, COVID, post-Brexit, cost of living crisis. I mean, that's the other one. And leaving the EU has, you know, raises all sorts of interesting and potentially quite challenging questions about Scotland's status within these islands within the United Kingdom and vis-a-vis the EU that were not there in 2014, which, you know, don't appear to have good answers or convincing answers yet. So if you want independence, I'm not sure it's the best timing, but I agree that, you know, clearing the air, fine. If that resolves matters one way or another, fine, no problem
with
that.
Although I suppose what you're saying is we could easily end up with pretty 50-50 and it wouldn't resolve the things either way. But anyway, Pat, have you got something you want to bring in at this point?
Because I mean, what I was considering there then, Andy, is why do you think we are on this balance point? Is it a failure of the Scottish Parliament and, in essence, the Scottish Government, the SNP, now with the support of the Greens, to enact policies that are going to attract more people to the concept of a progressive, left of centre, fairer, more equal Scotland?
No, I mean, I think these are different order questions. I mean, I think the current administration of whatever colour could be governing very, very competently and doing really, really well and riding high in the opinion polls and managing to build ferries on time and in budget, et cetera, et cetera. That does not necessarily correlate with support or indeed opposition to independence. I think it's a completely separate order question. Mm-hmm. I certainly believe that the arguments for independence are helped by the fact that the party proposing it is governing competently. I mean, I don't deny that. That's true. And if it's not governing competently, it somewhat takes away some of the arguments for, because, you know, people do begin to wonder what, you know, whether you'd be able to build any ferries in an independent Scotland. But I mean, I think these are different order questions. And, you know, my view is that the I don't know. I don't know if we've really drilled down into Scottish opinion yet. I mean, I don't think it's as straightforward as some people feel more Scottish than British, some people feel more British than Scottish. Some people are more left of centre, others are more sympathetic to the centre, the centre-right. I don't think any of these explain why we're split down the middle on independence. I think what we haven't done, what we haven't really examined in any great detail is, you see, independence is just, it's kind of, well, do you want to become an independent country like many other countries? You join the global community as an independent state. And there's very few countries around the world that have done that just because someone came along and said this might be a good idea. I mean, most countries that become independent, certainly in Europe, have done so in the aftermath of the breakup of the Soviet Union. Well, in recent years, that's it. You know, it has taken a fairly traumatic political event, the falling of the Berlin Wall, the ending of, you know, 40 years of major bloc politics in Europe, for the pieces to be reordered. And then in the 50s and 60s, of course, countries became independent in Asia and Latin America and Africa through decolonization. So it's been those big forces. And I think it's actually quite hard, objectively, you know, to persuade people to move away from a state of affairs which, you know, albeit people are very, very unhappy with the Tories and Boris Johnson and all the rest of it. And that is part of the motivation for independence. But it has to be more than that. So, yes, I just don't think the push factors are big enough yet, perhaps, or indeed the pull ones, because the pull ones are, you know, Leslie, you've done a lot of work in Nordic Horizons and all the rest of it, bringing to public attention, you know, how smaller countries that are our neighbours across the sea organise themselves. And it's a very compelling argument to say, well, of course, if Ireland or Denmark, you can become independent countries with just a few million people, broadly the same size as Scotland, no reason why we can't. And I think everyone actually agrees with that. I mean, I don't know anyone who would disagree with that. The question is, you know, should we still? And I think we're historically, I think we're a disputatious people. I think we are innately conservative with a small c, and believe that if change has to come, there has to be a compelling reason for it. So I think there's just a high degree of scepticism out there at the prospect of independence. And that's not overcome by, like, let's have another independence referendum. And I think that has to be overcome by a very subtle, quite smart cultural revolution. And I think very little attention has been paid to that. I think far too much attention has been paid, you know, to the politics. I'm also, incidentally, you know, I mean, the nation state is a very modern concept. It only came into being, you know, 100 years ago or so. And I think the way the world's going is, you know, I want to break down borders. I mean, my own politics is to have a confederal world where nation states don't sit down and argue with each other. Well, sure they do, but they do so within a much better governance framework. So, I mean, a lot of my thinking is about how you order, how you organize society in the modern era, where we have big challenges like the climate crisis to deal with. And in many ways, you know, the nation state is a bit of a fossilized relic of how to do things. Now, I mean, I realize that's a completely separate argument, and we're not going to get anywhere close to there fast. And as an independent state, we'd have far, far more influence in beginning to build a world order that's more like that. So in a sense, that's irrelevant. But I think overall, this has to be a cultural movement far more than it is at the moment.
But I suppose the thing would be, I mean, you're talking about some of the Nordic countries there. I mean, where there's been devolution of powers to the little Faroes or Greenland or whatever from Denmark, they don't cow it back again when they feel like it. You know, I mean, as far as I can see, Britain is practically the only place. And I've heard you bang on about this as well. Looking at Germany, for example, with the entrenched powers that local government has there, for example, where, as you have always pointed out, Angela Merkel can't impose a council tax freeze in Germany, not just because she's not the chancellor anymore, but, you know, and she was the most powerful woman practically in the world. And what characterizes Britain's devolved settlement, and I think what drives independence, is that you can't trust them. that there isn't anything entrenched, because that is not the way that the British Constitution works. And you could have all the talk you like about federalism in Britain. It's a different currency than the federalism you see anywhere else.
Yes. I mean, when I was talking about confederalism, I was meaning globally, not.
Yeah. But then how would anything but independence in this particular polity be a guarantee that you get taken seriously? Because, it looks like Westminster are quite capable of undoing any aspect of the Scottish Parliament.
No, I absolutely agree. I suppose all I'm really trying to say is that I'm not sure the extent to which that fundamentally political argument cuts through is still extremely limited. That's all I'm really saying. But I absolutely agree. I mean, Britain is a deeply, deeply unmodern state. I mean, I was speaking to a journalist who's doing a piece for the National Geographic on the Crown Estate, and he just struggling to get his head around why we have this institution still. And I said, well, basically, because Britain is an unmodern state. We've never had a revolutionary, or at least a successful revolutionary moment. You know, across Europe in the aftermath of the French Revolution, the powers of the monarchy were drastically curtailed, if not abolished completely. All the kind of financial powers were taken in by government. The lands of the kind of church and the crown were distributed amongst the local municipalities. And you had a fairly fundamental shift in power to the people and to the municipality, the parish. We've never, ever had that. You know, we had landed proprietors in the House of, still have landed proprietors in the House of Lords. But as of right until 1997, when the Labour government abolished most of them. And you're right as well. I mean, without a written codified constitution, the Scottish Parliament can be wound up. Scottish government can ride roughshod over the alleged rights of local government. Yes, we need to build a modern state. Absolutely. And that is a key driver for independence. But I suppose my argument, as I say, is that that's not sufficient in itself. There needs to be something more cultural, more soft, more... more appealing without having to engage in that kind of hard politics.
Can I just say that I'm just intrigued what you mean by cultural, Andy. And you were saying softer, more cultural. I mean, at some points people may go, oh, hold on a minute here. Are we moving into territory with which we are not very happy concerning, civil nationalism, as opposed to what we see in terms of nationalism elsewhere in its darker forms? I mean, are we talking about promotion of the Scots language, promotion of Gaelic, talking about specific Scottish cultural institutions, or is it deeper than that?
Right. No, I'm glad you asked that. I mean, it's not really about any of those things, although I think those things are relevant. No, it's more to do with a self-confidence and a belief that it matters how we're governed. Greater self-belief and self-confidence. That's what I'm really talking about. And that is a cultural phenomenon, right? That is born of the environment in which you live. So, I mean, if you're in desperate poverty and don't have much hope, you don't have much self-confidence or much self-belief, right? So that's not going to translate necessarily into support for major constitutional change. So it's more to do with the personal, the people's feelings, people's emotions, people's connection with each other. That's what I'm really talking about. So perhaps the choice of the word cultural is not the best one, but that's all I've got.
I was thinking as well that that in a sense Scotland is still a feudal country. I mean, we have only just astonishingly formally abolished feudalism in a legal way, and that feeling that you're slightly beholden, that there are powers that be behind you, that you're slightly looking over your shoulder, you're not quite sure if doing what you want is going to get you a whack out of the ear at some point. That to me is cultural. That sits within people, that kind of behaviour. And I wonder, can you talk about the Crown Estate and the difficulty getting that journalist to even get his head around the idea that, the Crown is the total feudal superior, is still kind of exerting that kind of pyramidic hierarchical control in the structures of our state. And I think that all works its way round to a sort of Dún Hoddan kind of outlook, to quote a book that's just been published by Alf Baird on that very topic. So just shifting over to the land reform, for which you are always famed and kind of which you're, I think, working on again. Where do you think we are with that, and what are you up to?
Okay, well, responding to the point you just made, I mean, I agree with you. I think we're still, as a society, very deferential to power. The one thing that really struck me when I was in Parliament was the extent to which civil society and people who, in my view, should have known better, just kind of waited for the Scottish Government to do something. You know, I remember speaking to a small charity, and they were waiting for the government to produce a draft strategy in their sector. And I said, well, when's it coming? And they said, well, we hope it's going to be in November. So this was March or so we were speaking. And I said, so what are you doing? And then it turns out they're just waiting. I said, well, you're the experts. Why didn't you draft the strategy? You know, I'm an MSP. I haven't a clue about this particular area. But if you draft one and tell me what it's all about, when the government comes out with it, so I'll be able to compare and contrast. I'll be better informed. You'll be on the front foot. Maybe the government will produce a better one because of what you've done. You know, get on the front foot. Be proactive. So anyway, I just wanted to get that out of my system because I really feel strongly that as partly the part of the cultural baggage. Absolutely. Now, that relates to land reform, really, because the same kind of deference, the same kind of helplessness, the same kind of inferiority complex has been inculcated in us because of the way the land system works. We are not a liberated owner-occupier country. We're not, you know, Ireland post-1900, 1920, 1930. We're not Scandinavia, Finland post 1920. We're still living in our communities, whether urban or rural, and these express themselves in different ways, obviously, depending on whether you live in towns and cities or the countryside. But we're still living with a power system over land, which we all need in many ways, directly for a place of shelter, for a home, indirectly for kind of food and energy and all the rest of it. Still living in a land system, which is essentially feudal, socially and culturally, if not legally, and which power is arbitrated in distant places for large sums of money. You have very little control over it. And, you know, I remember my sister, when she went to live in, she lives in Switzerland. She's lived in Switzerland now for decades. Works as a healthcare worker. She's my twin sister, and she's never actually been very particularly interested in politics, as I would see it. You know, I would talk to her in 1997 about the forthcoming devolution referendum, and she was, you know, interested, but not kind of totally, exercised by the whole thing. And I just thought, well, that's fine. You know, a lot of people are not interested in that kind of thing. But then there was one day when I had a conversation with her about what was happening in her municipality, and whoa, it was like someone had turned on the taps full blast. It was just like, she is political. There's just so much stuff going on. I think it was actually the point where I discovered that the Marquess of Dumfries, Johnny Dumfries, who now I think has passed away, but he kind of owned the Isle of Bute in a strange charity, which is a bit dodgy. Anyway, he's got a house there. And she was talking about where he lived and all the rest of it. So the thing is that, you know, I mean, to my mind, we need land reform and we need democratic governance reform. We need control closer to people about the things that really matter to them. And that includes how their land is owned and used. And that's what they do in the Swiss municipality. You know, I mean, Switzerland's a bit mad, really, with all the referenda and things. But they... I remember her taking me into the local municipal office, and there was people in there looking at who owned land in the municipality, and they had big maps and stuff. You know, the ski company wanted a bit of land, or the municipality itself was trying to put in a new drainage system for the roads or the hospital, and just all the details are there. You know, everything that really matters to that community in terms of the governance of its primary healthcare, its primary education, its land allocation, its planning, its environments, all done there. A really empowered community. And you can't do that without land reform. So, yeah, another facet of how Britain Scotland as part is a very, very unmodern country.
And so what are you up to then? Because I wonder if that earlier example that you talked about, where you were looking at the kind of group coming forward, waiting patiently until the, you know, proposed legislation might rumble around. Well, there's supposedly going to be a Land Reform Act coming from the Scottish Government. Are you waiting for it to rumble round?
Well, no. I mean, I was singularly uninspired by the the joint programme for government thing, the SNP manifesto. They're going to consult stakeholders. I've no idea who stakeholders are. But their only proposition is some kind of public interest test in the sale of large land holdings. I mean, this is the problem with land reform over the past 20 years, is we've tweaked around the edges. You know, in the first session or two, we did a lot of important legal reform around leasehold tenure, real burdens, tenement law, abolition of feudal tenure, etc. Those were long overdue and important, but fairly dry things, but also community right to buy, access rights, etc. And then latterly, we've been very focused on community, as if community can fix things. And I think, you know, the current debate around sort of green lairds and the amount of speculative money that's coming in on the back of carbon revenues, etc. Communities are being frozen out of that because they can't afford to compete in this kind of market. Well, duh. Well, of course they can't. And that's, you know, exposes the weakness of trying to rely on, or trying to kind of force on communities to fix problems that are deeply, deeply structural. You know, if your local police force were not, you know, delivering a decent policing service, you know, government wouldn't say, well, you, the community run it. If you, you know, if the primary school, if your children weren't getting a decent education, the government doesn't turn around and say, well, you take over the, you know, the education system. But if your land system is failing you, that's about all the government tells you. Here's some money, run it yourself. Now, absolutely, I want to see more communities running their own affairs, right? But it's not the answer to deeply structural problems in the way that land is owned in Scotland. So, and I've always been frustrated that, you know, the land reform bills that we've had have been a bit kind of itsy bitsy, never really got to the kind of heart of the matter. So, yeah, I am currently drafting something. Actually, I promised if I was elected, I would do a Land for the People bill. And what I'm hoping to get into this is a wide range of measures that I hope will be more of a comprehensive programme dealing with some of the issues that we've neglected. For example, reform of the way the market works, not just giving communities some opportunities at the edges, but fundamentally, how does the market in land work and how can we get more public benefits out of this market? Dealing, for example, with fiscal reform and tax. You know, we've never really done that. And this is one of the failings. Scottish Government land reform is meant to be a cross-cutting issue across government, a bit like dealing with climate crisis. But it's not been that. You know, I was in Parliament when we had the non-domestic rates bill. You know, people had made, including the Land Reform Review Group, had made specific recommendations about reform to non-domestic rates. Didn't feature in that bill, didn't get into it. And then thirdly, we've got a whole series of kind of tenurial things around kind of common land, about reforming the law of the foreshore and the seabed, which was, there's a Law Commission report from 2003. I mean, I want the seabed to come back into public ownership, get rid of the Crown's ownership of it, give the foreshore to local authorities, repeal the 1695 Act that allows commons to be divided. Lots of kind of detailed, bit kind of geeky stuff, but a lot of stuff that's just been neglected for too long. And I hope, you know, and in the course of this, tackling housing crisis and also giving opportunities to more than just kind of communities, right? Communities that have to set themselves up as corporations, essentially, they have to set themselves up as companies, giving opportunities more to local authorities, to local businesses, to local individuals, etc. So yes, hopefully by the end of May, this will, a first draft, as it were, of this bill I will publish, and I hope it'll act as a stimulus to, well, people, if not government, to think more deeply, more broadly and more ambitiously about what's possible, frankly, and what's needed.
That is brilliant to hear. Just by the by, are you getting any funding to do this stuff? I mean, are you getting work that lets you, you know, earn a living to support this kind of work?
No, I've got no funding to do this specifically. So I'm being very careful about what I'm doing. I'm getting little bits of work now and again. Obviously, trying to seek work when you've had a full-time job for 5 years is a challenge, but I'm slowly getting there. But no, this is not funded.
Okay. And then, Pat, you've got a thought on the Land for the People Bill?
Yeah, because there's a kind of practical point here, Andy, which is how does it go from being an activist, you know, putting together great ideas and ideas that sound fantastic to me, to getting it to become parliamentary business? Is there any indication there could be any parliamentary support from this from anybody in the Scottish Parliament currently?
Well, one of the good things about the 2016 Act was it set up the Scottish Land Commission, and that it's a kind of government agency that's charged with thinking about land reform on a permanent basis. And that's helpful because prior to that, the cause and interest had sort of waxed and waned. In fact, I mean, I think shortly after 2007, I remember speaking to a senior SNP minister who said, "We've done enough on land reform." I was quite shocked, and I'm not quite sure why they said that. You know, so that's the danger, because land reform is not just about, or shouldn't just be about, kind of tinkering with things. And government's good at tinkering, Parliament's good at tinkering. It's actually about reforming fairly deeply embedded, what I would call kind of archaeological power, stuff that's been there for centuries. Now, that's neither easy to do, nor can you do it that quickly. And it needs political, substantial political will and commitment. So to answer your question, no, I don't think the political will and commitment is there either in government or in Parliament. And that's partly because we're not good at thinking about developing and implementing deep-seated reform, because it takes time and patience. And generally speaking, any administration has just got 4 years. Now, that's not to say that you can't do it. How you do it is you build strong cross-party consensus that we need to do X, Y, or Z. And then you work with that consensus through one, two, or maybe three parliaments. And that's what needs to be done with land reform. We need that consensus on the kind of fundamental changes we need. And even if we don't get them quickly, as long as everybody agrees, we can work towards them. But that doesn't exist yet. And even the Scottish Land Commission is working to kind of, you know, three-year programs of activities that have to be signed off by ministers. So they're not completely independent doing blue skies thinking and saying to government, what about X, Y, and Z? You know, they're working on a program of work that's already been signed off by ministers and to an extent reflects their views on what we need to do next. So We'll see. I mean, part of this is about education. I mean, a lot of the issues here are not well understood. And it's not like transport or health or environment, where you have quite a lot of organisations in the private and the public and charitable, voluntary sector, in academia, etc., that are familiar, broadly speaking, with environmental arguments and transport policy. Land reform is not something that has had institutional support. You know, there's a handful of academics now taking an interest in it, but that wasn't always the case. It's historically been a small bunch of activists and people on the political margins. Mm-hmm. And in that changes, it's going to be, that's just an additional hurdle, I think.
Yeah, because you've got the paradox you said there, that governments operate in four-year cycles, but we have, in the current constitutional impasse, I think, the prospect that there will continue to be an SNP-led Scottish government with or without Green support. So why do you think there's such reticence amongst the SNP in terms of its ministers to enact meaningful land reform?
I honestly don't know. I have some theories. I mean, one is that the SNP isn't a coherent political organisation. Its one big idea is independence, and they all agree on that. That's fine. But unlike Labour, unlike the Conservatives, they don't have a particular political philosophy or economic philosophy. There's people in the SNP from the right and from the left, and they market themselves as a kind of centre-left social democratic party. But, you know, just when I was in there, Fergus Ewing was a minister who blocked dozens of things. you know, and he's perfectly entitled to do that. But you wouldn't have got that within a Labour government, for example. You know, it would have had people on the right and left, but you wouldn't have had such extremes. And I think with fiscal conservatives and fiscal progressives, with social conservatives and social progressives all mixed up in one party, that is a drawback. The second is the lack of people in the SNP with a lot of they've lost a lot of very experienced people. Their depth of talent and depth of experience there is not great. You know, if Nicola Sturgeon were to walk away tomorrow, you know, what would happen? And you do need very strong, committed, experienced politicians running government, because one of the problems is the civil service. I say it's a problem. They are, by their nature, conservative. And there's been very few occasions in Scottish devolution when ministers have stood up to civil servants who've said, well, Minister, that would be a very brave decision. That's very difficult. You know, there's all these kind of legal problems. And the number of occasions when ministers have stood up and said, well, look, I understand all that. I take all your point, but I'm afraid, you know, we're going to do this, you know. And that's a problem with land reform, because the assumptions within the permanent government are that land reform is something to be done iteratively, to do kind of little things along the way, where, you know, there's no conception that this could be a genuinely revolutionary approach that would completely change the way we regard land, its ownership and use, indeed its governance. That just does not exist in the civil service. And then the other thing, which is generic to all political administrations, of course, is, as I mentioned earlier, there's a limited amount of kind of expertise and analysis and ideas coming from outside. Very, very limited.
So coming back to the Land for the People Bill, are you looking to get people to support it then? Is that the strategy that different groups, basically civic society, gets behind this and essentially pushes it onto the agenda in Holyrood?
Well, in an ideal world, Leslie, yes. I mean, I don't actually view it like that, because I think there's a lot of kind of education, understanding and awareness to be done. So that's the kind of main focus initially, because I think there's going to be a lot in here that people think, wow, I hadn't thought of that, or I don't know much about it. So the idea that they would just kind of, you know, without knowing much about it or thinking about much or understanding much about it, would just kind of say, yeah, let's go with this. You know, for example, we've got this debate about so-called green lairds, a term I don't like, incidentally, but people coming in with speculative capital want to buy up land, get carbon credits, sell them or use them to offset their emissions, etc. Now, my proposal, but the problem, I mean, there's lots of problems with that. So how do we deal with that? At root, that's a governance issue, because the atmosphere, which is the carbon, should be governed as a commons. Okay, there's commons regimes around the world. The high seas is a commons, and the Nobel winning economist Eleanor Ostrom prove that commons regimes around the world are very, very successful, and they fail due to predictable and known reasons, and they're successful because of known and predictable reasons. And therefore, my proposal is we should turn the atmosphere into a commons, and we should have a commons regime, and it should be governed by rules. Whereas at the moment, we're treating the atmosphere as an extension of the land, which legally it is. If you own a square of land in Scotland, you own a triangle. You own down to the centre of the earth and up to the heavens above. Sorry, not a triangle, pyramid. You actually own a pyramid. And of course, if someone owns a top floor flat and a building's then demolished, they still own that little bit of airspace, right? They need to get other people to support what they want to build or support it themselves, but they own that airspace. But you don't own right up to the heavens above. I mean, the 1920s, when civil aviation became a thing, legally speaking, if you wanted to fly from London to Edinburgh, you did need the permission of every landowner. You were going to overfly. So we amended the law to allow people to do that without getting the requisite permission. So, for example, that's just one example where I think we need to have a commons regime for the atmosphere. Now, no one's really talking about that. That in Scottish policy terms, that's a new idea. So although I think there'll be a lot in it that people will feel able to get behind, absolutely, and I do want that, I think as much as I want that to happen, I want people to engage with the ideas and think and help develop them as well, because that's really important. We need to improve what I call land literacy, people's ability to engage with this issue, understand what, you know, what bit of the jigsaw they need to be looking at, and broadly speaking, understand what levers to pull. And we're still very poor at that in general.
Well, I can sense that the phone is possibly reaching the end of its life on this one. So, I mean, this is all fascinating and, you know, as ever, all power to your elbow. Is there anything then that would make you want to stand again for Holyrood?
Not now, no, but I wouldn't rule it out in future.
You tantalizing
yes, tease.
Activist, you. Yeah, yes. Yep. Okay, well, that's fascinating stuff. Well, thanks very much indeed, Andy, and we wait for the Land for the People Bill to, you know, pop out May after that and be part of whatever education we need to kind of throw off that deference that you described so well. So many thanks, Andy Whiteman.
Thank you.